Morning to all. My name is Tandi Mpambo Sifukwana. I'm a member of the of this committee chaired by Honorable Zwane, and I represent the Western Cape province.
Good morning, Chairperson, colleagues, and our guests. My name is Ntomo Shekaula, a member of the NCOP from the Kingdom of KwaZulu.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Herman Groenewald, representing the Northwest Province and a member of the committee.
Good morning, Sanbonani. I'm Kathy Wagatamene, member of the committee representing Mpumalanga and the province of the Rising Sun. Thank you.
Thank you very much. But there is no kingdom there. The only province is the kingdom is KZN. Let me head over to council to introduce ourselves, please.
Good morning, members. My name is Thulaganyo Mothusi, Chief Financial Officer.
Good morning, members. Honorable one. I'm Denise Webstock, and I'm acting CEO of the Council on Higher Education.
Thank you, and good morning, honorable members. My name is Tembo Masia. I'm the chairman of the Council on Higher Education.
Good
morning, honorable chair and members. James Tredu, CFO of the department.
Good morning, honorable members. Hanelie van Reesburg, Director of University Academic Planning, Monitoring and Evaluation in the University Branch.
We're all introducing ourselves at the back.
Good morning, my name is Lunto Fischer from the Parliamentary Monitoring Group. Thank you.
Over to you, Police Secretary.
My name is Mzuyan Rang. I'm the Secretary to the Committee.
Good, sir.
Good morning, my name is Kutu Mankai, I'm a committee coordinator of this committee.
No, thank you very much. I don't know if there are any apologies from which you said Kutu.
We've got apologies from the ministry, deputy minister, and minister, as well as the DG of the department. From the committee side, we've got two apologies, Honorable Matthias and Honorable Stock. Those are the only apologies.
Thank you. From the side of the support staff, I got an apology from Linda Stafford. She's it. No, thank you very much. Let us get started with the business of the day. But maybe before we start, a chairperson of council, we do recognize the fact that this is the digital reporting established in terms of an act of higher education. I think it's Act number 101 of 1997. And of course, a specific mandate to perform on behalf of higher education, that is to ensure that you advise the Minister of Higher Education from time to time on any issue that you need to advise him on, but also to ensure that we maintain the quality. We maintain the high standard of performance at the level of higher education, but also to inform the public and publicize any issue that is of public interest on matters affecting the higher education sector. To that extent, you are then expected to come before the select committee to present your strike plan, your 5-year strike plan, as well as your annual performance plan, as you did probably with the portfolio committee. As you heard us introducing ourselves, our interest is always based on provinces. We want to know what is happening in the various provinces that you represent, with a view to actually going back to our constituencies and ensure that we relay the information that would affect them, that relates to the departments that we exercise oversight on. So we are going to be expecting you then to tell us how you are going to go about executing your strike plan and how it is aligned to the various pieces of legislation that govern you, how it relates to even the National Development Plan, how it relates to SONA as pronounced by the President of the country, and all relevant instruments that you have to align yourself with whenever you draw your strike plan as well as your annual performance plan. I do not know how you've divided the presentation amongst yourself, you know, but let me hand over to the Chairperson of Council to lead the way, and then we'll hear from you as to how we're going to go about doing the presentation. Thank you. Over to you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. We thank you for this invitation. I think it's the first invitation that we have in the Select Committee. And we appreciate sharing with you what the Council on Higher Education is doing or is also planning to do in the next 5 years. The work of the CHE is underpinned by values such as transformation, integrity, and public accountability, as it is demonstrated by this visit that we have. But in terms of the Act, I mean, this is an independent statutory body that advises the minister, as you have enunciated. And the two very contextual areas that we are working on are based on the Act, as you have indicated, and where we monitor trends in higher education through research and other interactions, conferences, and so on and so forth, and therefore provide advice on the state of higher education. We also have to look after the quality of our offerings across the sector, and that we do through various mechanisms, accreditation, audits, and so on and so forth. So we have recently, obviously, as you know, been tasked with overseeing the higher education qualification sub-framework, looking at qualifications through the NQF Act. That was in 2008, because the CHE is also now a quality council. So we manage this framework in line with the prescriptions of that Act. These are just a few high-level elements of what we do. Of course, there are many challenges in the higher education sector, as you know. We have had in the past, if we move to the next slide, that's a different one, that's the whole overview. Yeah. We have in the past, Jefferson, been having a few challenges in terms of capacity. The CHE is not a very big organization, but the impact of the work that comes out of there is quite huge for the sector. special factors that we have since 2000. I mean, we started in 1998 through to now. It's a very long history for now in higher education, because we have been auditing institutions. We are continuing to accredit institutions and account publicly. So this is by and large, I think, the kind of work that we do. And I'm going to hand over to the acting CEO to take us through elements of our strategic plan, and then the CFO will take us through the METF framework and budget expenditure and so on and so forth. I'll hand over to Denise to take.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson and members, and thank you for affording us this opportunity to explain our strategic plan and our annual plan and what our plans are for this financial year. I think in starting that, perhaps we can go one slide up, just to, up the other way. I think maybe just to give you an idea of some of the work that we did in the last 18 months preceding this particular plan, so that I can just give you a flavor of what it is that we do. Up again, overview. Okay. In the last 18 months before this particular strategic plan, in line with our mandate, as has been explained now a number of times, the advice and the monitoring, looking after quality, and also managing our sub-framework of qualifications, there are a number of projects that we were very busy with in those 18 months. The one was looking at undergraduate curriculum reform. I think you may know that we have been faced with challenges in the higher education sector of poor throughput rates, and our huge worry was about how are we going to get our children in this country through higher education. Is there some way that we can change the system to ameliorate some of those matters? And we did some research and produced a proposal on that, which is that first one. Also, in line with our concern about the quality of teaching and learning in higher education, we launched in 2014, I think just at the beginning of 2014, so in the last financial year, a quality enhancement project, and that was about getting all the universities to work together to identify some of their major problems in teaching and learning in a number of particular focus areas. And that's designed to last 5 years. So it's really about collaborating, finding the problems and finding the solutions, and the CHE is facilitating that process. We're some way down the line in that, and I'll talk a little bit more about that when I talk about the actual plans that we have. And then we also undertook, and this has straddled financial year, a review of the state of higher education. The CHE has traditionally every 5 to 10 years done a review, mostly an academic sort of project, looking at what has happened in higher education in that time, what are the main challenges, and give some recommendations for the way forward. That was a big one. We had some 50 academics working on that, and we're in the final stages of producing that document now. Then, as part of managing our sub-framework, which is the Higher Education Qualification Sub-Framework, you will know that there are three different sections on the NQF, so ours has to do with higher education. As part of that, we undertook a revision of the entire framework because we thought the way that it had been in place or designed had not given enough opportunity for professional qualifications, and we wanted more articulation pathways and so on. So we went through a major process of consultation with all the stakeholders and revised it somewhat, and that was gazetted first in 2013 and then again in 2014, separately from the other frameworks. And then, having said that we now have a new framework of qualifications, the task was to say, how do we get all the current qualifications at all the various universities and universities of technology, etc., aligned with that new framework? It was a massive task that we undertook. Again, it spanned financial years, which is why I'm talking about it, because we're in the final throes of that now. And that was a process of aligning some more than 10,000 qualifications across the system with that framework in three phases, which again I'll explain when we talk about the actual nitty-gritty of the plan and what we're doing in this financial year. And then as part of managing the sub-framework, this is something that SACRA used to do, but was passed on to us as a particular job, and that was to develop standards for particular qualifications. So we first had to develop a framework for how we were going to do that, and since then we have developed qualification standards for five particular qualifications. And now we are using those in the process of reviewing all of the programs that lead to that qualification throughout the sector. I'll give you an example. We have just completed a national review of the Bachelor of Social Work, and we have a standard that came out of that process for future reference and for developing future Bachelor of Social Work programs. But at the same time, we developed one for the LLB, and we're starting the national review of the LLB now, so that we have, it's come through the people who are working in the sector, the legal academics, the law society, all the various stakeholders have worked together on producing that so that we can hold them to account on that. I've just mentioned the Bachelor of Social Work review. And then, of course, we do a lot of quality promotion work that's bringing together people in the sector. And when I talk about the sector, it's the public universities and also the private ones, private higher education institutions, to bring them together to discuss some of the quality-related issues that might come up. Okay. We talked a bit about the next slide. Julie, can you go down one? I think a few other context factors I might need to list now. Our chair of council talked about the values that we hold dear and that we really do think underpin the work that we do. But I think there are a number of other issues that might be important to know. For the last 20 years, we're really working higher education understood as universities. But of course, since 2009, the landscape has changed to post-school. So some of our work now looks at the relationship between universities and colleges, for example. So it's changed the landscape somewhat. We have a very broad scope of activity. So because we have a mandate coming from two acts, that means that we have quite a lot to cover with, as our chair said, a few people, really. We are also in a climate where we have some cuts, fiscal cuts, and so we've had to take that into account. And I think our approach to that has been to reorganize our project, see what we can do with what we have. And then, of course, we are looking again at a changed institutional landscape. They're not the same institutions we had 20 years ago. This is very much post-merger. So coming to our strategic plan for the next 5 years. Very simply, we have four major goals for the next 5 years, and we've had them in the last period as well. They've not changed radically. And the first is really about enhancing our policy analysis and information function. And that includes our advice to the minister, that includes putting our data on the higher education system, that includes looking at what are the trends that we need to take account of, and that might inform some research projects that we develop. The second is to take hold of that mandate of managing the higher education sub-framework and the standards in terms of quality. And that's a new quality function. We always had audits of institutions and we always accredited programs, but this is pretty much taking hold of that new one, and as I explained, that has engendered some big projects like aligning all the qualifications with the HQSS. The third relates to that, and that is developing the quality assurance system as a whole further for the system. And the fourth is about our, the organization itself, about our focus on building our own intellectual capacity and that of the sector, and building an enabling organizational climate so that we can do all the things that we would like to do. So that's why they're color-coded in terms of those four, because we have four strategic goals, but we have 12 strategic objectives which relate to those four. So the blue ones relate to the first one that I mentioned. Okay. So in terms of the policy analysis imperative, one of the goals there is to provide advice to the Ministry of Higher Education and Training, both at the Minister's request, and we do get requests for advice, and proactively. So if we're doing research, we might say, this is an area that we need to provide advice to the Minister of. There are two of those latter kind that are issues we'll be working with in this financial year. The one is some background work we have done about governance and management challenges in higher education. You will know that there have been some institutions that have had governance challenges, and the minister has had to have an administrator, maybe sometimes more than once. And our work was to try to understand what are the common issues, why do these things happen, and how best can we deal with those and provide some advice on that. So our background research phase is over, but in this year we will be refining that advice. And then secondly, I talked about the review that we did in the last 18 months, which is coming to a conclusion, and that we will also use to provide advice to the Minister. Then secondly, about monitoring the state of higher education in relation to that first major strategic goal, our focus in this financial year is to complete existing projects. We have one that is about student governance, trying to understand how it works, what are the different models, and so on. And the empirical work on that has been done and mostly written up, and so it's taking that one to a conclusion. The other one there is Reflections on Academic Leadership. That is a book that is sitting on my desk now, ready for a last check before going to the printers. And that's really a series of inputs from retired vice chancellors over the last 10, 15 years. And their advice to a new generation of vice chancellors, what did they learn as a vice chancellor about academic leadership, and what would they pass on? So some of those chapters they've written themselves, and the others we did on the basis of interviews with them. We have a number of ongoing projects. The one is a publication called Vital Stats, which does some cohort studies of students in higher education and the throughput rates and so on, but also a lot of numbers about higher education that we produce every year. We are now on the third one, I think. And related to that is to keep our website data interactive and updated so that people can find out information about higher education. And then we've also had another project going about placement mechanisms in higher education. In other words, once you've admitted students into higher education, what means do you use to make sure they do the right curriculum? We also know that some of the poor throughput rates have to do with the wrong choice of curriculum. So we're looking at those mechanisms. How best would you do that? What are the universities actually using? And could we improve on those? We have some new projects in mind to start to plan in this financial year. We will not do them in this financial year. The one is a big project about student funding. And I'm not only talking about student financial aid, but looking at a much bigger problem of how are we going to fund our students in the next 20 years? Where is the money? There's some different departments. There is NSFAS, but there's also other money. There's other bursaries. Institutions themselves make money available. But we also need to look at the model of how we do that. Are we doing it in the best way possible with the resources that we have? So that's one that is we're in the process of planning. The other one comes out of the review that we did on higher education. And that is about, it's, we know the numbers of staff in higher education, and we know about the lack of transformation and staffing in higher education. We know all the numbers. What we don't know enough about is what the experience is in higher education. So this is a more qualitative study looking at what is it that informs a person's choice when they have a PhD, whether they stay within higher education or they go somewhere else. Do we have enough understanding of that? Do we have enough understanding of what it means on a daily basis for somebody to work in that area? Has it changed? A lot of work in that. And the other one, we started with a colloquium on this, and we're now refining that into a project. And that's more about what are the policy implications of the greater use of information and communication technology in higher education? Are there possibilities for some of our institutions to use that to actually leapfrog a whole level of development, in a sense, and to improve quality? We're going to look at that one. Okay, and then in terms of the second, which is about our sub-framework, this is about managing the sub-framework and the standards and so on. I talked about the alignment of the 10,000 programs with the HEQSF. We have been through all of those programs that needed just a little bit of work to align. We've been through what we call Category B, which are those that needed some curriculum development to align, and evaluated all of those. And now what we're left with is those that are being replaced, that could not align. And so as institutions are developing new programs, they're putting them through our accreditation process. So every new program is coming through. So at the moment we have quite a lot of BEds, for instance, because we have to align with two new frameworks and so on. Also there we are looking at the articulation, as I said, between universities and colleges. The colleges, as you know, are being reinvigorated. And so we're looking at how do we make sure that their offerings and university offerings articulate well, and what do we need to do to make that happen. And the other one there is the external terrain, if you like, for universities and quality assurance has got very complex. We have many, many professional bodies coming to accredit programs at universities. Many of them charge a lot. It's confusing for the institution, and it's not always clear how they relate to what we do. So we are working with them to develop a new framework for the system to clarify it all. It's been an ongoing problem for the last 15 years. And then the developing and implementing the policy criteria and standards for development, registration, and publication of qualifications. I talked about the development of the pilot standards. Now, they are now out there for public comment. And assuming that they are accessible, and they should be because they've been worked on by the people who need to use them, we will need to extend that to further qualifications. And ultimately, in this financial year, we will have a conference or a colloquium on the whole process of standards development so people know what we're doing on that. And then to maintain a database of learner achievements, complicated stuff, that what it really means is that we keep the enrollments and whether somebody has achieved a qualification in a particular database that's managed for us by SACWA, so that any person who has done a qualification can go and find out, or an employer can go and find out that that qualification is there. Mostly that happens through the department, through HEMIS data, but this is particularly about the private sector because there was no way of collecting their data, so that's what we do there. And we are also developing that system so that we can also monitor what's happening in the private higher education sector better. Okay. Then the quality assurance development. This is the goal there is to, well, our function is really to audit the quality assurance mechanisms of of universities, and that's ongoing. We've had a 10-year process of looking into how every university manages its own quality and what processes and so on they have. There are a number of those that are still busy working on institutional improvement plans, which we monitor. And then I also talked about, we have for the moment decided to focus on actually trying to enhance the quality of what we have seen through the audit, through this quality enhancement project, and those are the focus areas we're looking at there. Where we've got to on that, all of the institutions have told us what they're doing in those particular areas. So we've now got a publication that's just come out this week on what all the institutions thought were their good practices and what their challenges were in those areas. There have been a number of national workshops where people from institutions have been working together on some of those areas, and they are now going to be giving in this financial year their second submissions to say, what have you done? How have you improved in relation to those things that you told us about in your baseline data? And then accreditation is an ongoing function that we have. So every new program that is offered, either by public or private, goes through our processes. Usually we do about 400 new programs in a year. Each of those is evaluated, goes through various committees and so on. But we also have now increased very much the actual site visits. So not only is it a paper-based process, but we'll put a panel together to go and look and see whether what they've told us on paper exists in reality. So we are expecting an increase of new program applications, as I told you about, with that alignment. We're getting all of those new programs through. And then to undertake national reviews of programs in specific areas. I already mentioned the one of, and what this means is that we look at the Bachelor of Social Work, for example, that is offered right across the country. So whether it's an institution X in your province or institution Y in somebody else's province, we look at all of them at the same time. And we've just finished the social work one, and we're starting the LLB one. Okay, and there are a few others that we are working with their bodies to see whether we should do those. And then the promotion of quality, I talked about quality assurance forums. We also work with other organizations. There's one called Haltasa, for instance, where we work on awarding national teaching awards, and this is in an attempt to raise the profile of teaching at universities. And we also train. We obviously, our systems rely on us using people in the sector to evaluate programs, for example, and to sit on panels for national reviews. And so we do the training of all of those. In this last financial year, I think we had 450 to train. And then finally, it's about focusing on further developing and enabling organizational climate. So, and that's about ensuring that our people are able to develop their full potential. So we're very big on wellness programs and training and so on. This is the one that my CFO likes, which is to ensure that the financial administration and supply chain management is compliant with all the laws. And the PFMA and so on, and also taking that into the ICT space as well. This is an ongoing process. We've put a lot of effort in the last years into reviewing all our policies and making sure we do everything correctly and by the book. And so with that, I'd say that that is, in a nutshell, our plan for 2015-16. In the context of our four broad strategic goals.
Thank you very much. I don't know who's coming next. It is able.
Chair.
Over to you.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. Money is just to give the members a picture of how our financials been structured. In terms of addressing the funding of all the programs or the strat plan as indicated by the acting CEO and the chairperson of the council. Just to highlight members, because for the first time presenting to you, this is how our budget has been allocated based on the baseline, which is mostly the grant that we receive from Department of Higher Education and Training. And in terms of the MTEF, we have a baseline original allocation was 43 for 2015-16, 45 for 2016-17, and 47 million for 2017-18. Due to the financial constraints within the government, within the country, we were requested by National Treasury together with the Department of Higher Education. There was a cut that was done in terms of the original grant allocation for 2015-16 and 2016-17. And the baseline reduction, as indicated above, reflects the reduction of our baseline in terms of the allocation. For 2015-16, we are left with 40.8 million, and then for 2016-17 is 40.9. For 2017-18 is still at 47.9. There's no cut. And we are trying to highlight to the members that the cut in terms of the percentage is 7% cut in terms of the grant allocation. And for 2016-17 is 10%. The question is that will we survive by this cut? What the CEO indicated is that obviously whether the cut is up to the management to try to achieve the objectives with the little budget that we have. And obviously it informs the reprioritization and privatization of the programs that we have together with the council members to advise which ones can we do with the little that we have. And this is the source of income for the MTF period. How are we getting our money? Besides the allocation that we are receiving from Department of Higher Education and National Treasury, based on the programs, as the CEO indicated, that on a yearly basis, there are new programs that are submitted by private institutions and public institutions. That's where we derive some of the income from, because we are charging these private institutions and public institutions in terms of the programs. So we normally focus in terms of how much are we going to get from this private accreditation. And then we also had a ring-fence amount that was done for the new mandate, which was done by the minister in terms of standard development. And also the other income relates to income interest and then the rental income that we receive from the bank. And in total, the other income that we receive, it amounts to, we've projected 7.0% and 5.7% in 2016-17 and 4.8% in 2017-18. I just want to highlight to members that the figures, that's the reason why when we normally report to Treasury, and I think they are aware, is that the figures might change. They sometimes do change because this is the projected income. It might happen that the income that we anticipated might be lower or higher. Hence, I want to stress the point that they might change. Also applying to the other income, it depends on what you have at the bank. The more you have, the more the income or the interest will be reflected. But the actual grant amount, which will never change, is the one that we get from the Department of Higher Education and National Treasury, which is 40.8 million and 40.9 million in 2016-17 and 47.9 million in 2017-18. So together, when you add the grant amount plus the other income that we anticipate to receive, the budget allocation for 2015-16 is 47.8 million, for 2016-17 is 46.2 million, for 2017-18 is 52.7. Now, this is how the allocation or the budget has been allocated for different programs or for different spending items for the entire MTF period. This is just estimation. We are just trying to highlight that for goods and services, which is compensation of employees, we have 30.1, 30.0, and 31.0 for 2017-18. just to highlight to the members that due to the fact that there were some cuts that were done in the prior years, when Treasury cuts the budget baseline, it cuts the base. The baseline is inclusive of the personnel costs and goods and services. Now, the members must understand that when the cut is done, there are already home bodies, which is officials or employees in the system. There's no way that SCHE we can say we are going to reduce the salary of an individual while the individual is already paid at a particular rate. Take into account that there are also increases that comes on an annual basis as per the DPSA mandate. So when you look at the budget in terms of COE, our budget allocation for compensation of employees is higher than the goods and services. It's because of the simple reason of that we already had home bodies before the cut is done. So the only cut that we can do is try to make sure that we go to goods and services and try to make sure that that's where we implement and reduce some of the cuts to make sure that we are within the baseline. So that is the only major problem that we are anticipating. If we look at our goods and services against the compensation of employees, our compensation of employees is almost about 52% compared to goods and services. And it's because of that explanation that I just made. The other issues as highlighted there is allocated to administration, computer services, and other spending items. And for payments of capital assets, this is all the allocation. Just to highlight that the building that we are occupying is our own building that was bought by the council. We are just maintaining the building for now, but not renting. So it's our own building, it's our asset. Other issues relate to software and other intangible assets, which we normally is for computer-related matters, where we have to buy computers, maintain computers, replace and dispose the computers that are not working in terms of their useful life. And you can look at the expenditure, the estimated expenditure is aligned to what has been allocated. Therefore, there's no deficit or over budgeting or under budgeting in terms of when you compare the source of income against the expenditure allocation. The MTF budget allocation per program, just to highlight to the members before I close, this is how we have allocated. In terms of CHE, we have about 5 programs. Administration takes into account CFO's office, corporate services, and CEO's office. The other 4 programs, we call them core programs. Monitoring and evaluation, institutional audits, accreditation, national review, and standard development. And the reason why administration is high, as I indicated now, is because of it's catering about 3 sub-programs. And on that program, there's legal fees, there's maintenance of the building. Majority of the obligatory payments are done at administration, which are the cleaning service contracts, which are the security contracts, and etc. That's the reason why the figure is higher than when you look at other programs. In addition to that, there are issues in terms of personnel, in terms of corporate services and COE, and also CFO. The number of employees in that subunits are higher compared to other programs, obviously depending on the scale of each individual. So the scale depends on how you pay officials. Obviously, the amount will be higher. Hence, the amount of administration compared to others is a little bit higher than the others. But when you look at the others, they are in between. And this is informed by the budget bill that has been submitted by individual programs. In terms of the programs that they are going to do, as per the presentation by the CMO in terms of the flat plan. So we allocate budget based on what they intended to do so that they can achieve the objectives as such in the flat plan. So in total, we make sure that this is aligned to the allocation of 47 for 2015-16, 46.2 for 2016-17, and 52.7 for 2017-18. And I think that's all from my side. It's just an indication that the members must note the allocation for the 2015-16. What we normally do, which we normally do to the portfolio committee, is how now the spending has been incurred in terms of what we intended to do. And just to highlight to members that CAG has been doing so well in terms of getting a very clean audit report since its inception up to so far, and we
No, thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. This is our presentation. We are happy to take any questions from the four of us, both Dave and myself as council members and the management of the council and our association. We believe that the organization is making a very serious impact nationwide in terms of monitoring quality and also increasing and enhancing the intellectual capacity in the sector. We are very interactive with institutions. We are always with private providers in various ways, site visits or accreditation of programs and things like that. And we are happy to take any comments or questions based on the presentation.
Thank you very much. Let me hand over to the honorable members for comments and questions. Honorable Reverend, Honorable Kaona, Honorable Samir.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for the presentation as well. There's a lot of questions, and I'm very happy today I'm sitting on this side of the fence and not on your side. I believe there's a lot of challenges. Firstly, regarding accommodation, I think it is going hand in hand with what you've done and doing in on the ground. And that is really a problem at this stage in all our institutions. And what I want to know, what role are you playing to assist the institutions regarding accommodation in all the areas where we have this higher education? What is your relationship with NAFSAS? Are you aware exactly what is going on there, how they use their funds, and are you also aware of the policies? Are there policies in place? I think that is very important to know it. There's an investigation on from the minister's side, and how far is this investigation? And does it all have to do with money and to assist our students at universities and in institutions? How are you managing it from your side? Then what is quite interesting is the curriculums you are also involved in, and I think if I'm listening correctly, you are playing a very main role in this whole situation. What techniques do you use to see that all the universities are on the same level? And I think you explained it in some sense to us, but you can give us more clarity about it. I'll appreciate it. Because I want to know, because that is quite interesting. We've got different culture groups in different universities, and to get all these people or students on the same level so that we have a good quality of a degree or a diploma, I think you play a very big role in this whole situation, and you are busy with it, but give us a bit more information regarding that. And then I'm coming from the Northwest province. At this stage, we have some problems at the university, the amalgamation with the three campuses. One is in the Gauteng province, and the other two is in the Northwest province. And we know all the provinces' standards and are not on the same level. What are you doing regarding that? How do you assist the Northwest University with all the inner questions they have at this very moment there? And how are you involved in this whole situation? And then the data of all the universities and institutions, how are you keeping this data updated so that with all the fraud we have in the recent time where people apply for certain high level posts and they handed in diplomas and degrees they haven't got, so how can we see if they have really have it? So is your data really up to date and can we make use of it? You also mentioned you make use of cons- 2.3 million is allocated for them in your department. What are their job? What are they really do? What are you really do with them in your institution or in your committee? There's something about the accreditation, but I'll ask it for the later stage. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Chef, and thanks to the content for the presentation. I see that your compensation of employees is taking a big chunk of your budget. For the MTF, you did not tell us what the structure of your organization is like, which leaves very little for your service delivery program. Can you maybe just outline the structure for us? Like you said, this is the first time we're meeting you. And I also noticed that in your income from that which doesn't come from government, it goes down as the with the MTF. 7 million, 5 million, 4 million. I would like to know what are the reasons for that. And Chairperson, there seems to be a very thin line between SACA and Cancer and Higher Education. What I would like to know is when people come from outside the country, either for work purposes or for education purposes, how do you gauge the level of what they have achieved to what they want to get into in the country, so as to ensure that there is a balance that which comes from outside the country. It equates the education we have in the country for all purposes and also for further education purposes. There has also been this notorious issue of fraudulent qualifications in the country. It has affected institutions, it has affected I think the medical profession too. What is your role in that? Where do you come in on that one? And lastly, as parents in our other lives, we are also interested in having our children, as South Africans, all of us, getting the best of education. As a result, you'll find out that people move from point A to point B trying to get their children to institutions. Are you involved in maybe ranking institutions in respect of quality education, and those that are struggling, because there is that perception out there, a general perception that institution A is better than institution B. Those that are struggling, what is your role? I don't want to mention names, but we have our own perception in those communities that A is better than B. Now, in your professional work as the counselor, what do you do to ensure that at least, because I think that is the gist of your work, that the perception is not there, that the standards are maybe the same, because it even affects people who have qualifications when they go for work, because some employers, even when it comes to taking people for work, it counts as to where you have been. It's one of the things that will be psychologically the back of the minds of the people who are sitting there giving you employment to say, where did you get your qualification? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. My greetings again. I want to start off with the CFO. I noticed you tried your best to justify the amount there. No, that slide is not there. Where you have 20 million versus other figures below there. You try your best. Why you have personnel, more money there, because already you have home bodies before the money is cut. But the cut, we're only talking about the cut this financially now.
I don't know how many years have you been having this trust and the story, but my issue there is that my real understanding of an organization is that structure follow function. You first start with what you want to do, then you come up with your structure. That is the general logic in terms of how you fund your personnel or your structure, your organogram in an organization. The second matter is on the student funding. Very much glad or happy to see that at least you are attempting to deal with this matter. Because it's not only the students, individual students who want to study, but us as a country, we do want to contribute in terms of improvement of the socioeconomic status of our people, for the country, for the people to be out of this poverty trap. As education, as a sector, there must be an input that we put so that we change the status. Then my question is, what are the comparison studies? What informs now? What informs your thinking that now let's look at the funding of our students, how we fund our students? What triggered that? What are the comparison studies? Where to who are you comparing with? Are you just thinking without comparing with other countries how they do funding for the students? One would be more interested to see which countries or models or studies that you are using in order to inform your advice to the minister or the government in terms of how we fund, or the country, we fund our students. It linked to that question, what advice would you give the minister, or do you give the minister? You know our status in terms of socio-economic status of the country, different communities, given our background. How much input for us as a country to say we want by this year to be here in terms of socio-economic status? How much input do we have to put as government through the sector of education? Because my belief is that an educated nation is a developing society. I don't know examples, I don't have examples. If I may put a simple example to say, for us as a country to be out of poverty traps in 2050, for example, we have to make education free. For example, I'm just thinking aloud. Free. We must make sure that, because it's not only tuition fee. Tuition fee is a smaller amount in education. Your accommodation is the main thing. Your textbooks and everything. As a package, what do you advise the minister to do so that we don't really wait for students to come and say, because I have money, I can go to the university? What should be the input of this sector in order to change the status of the country in terms of socio-economic status? The issue of EICT, very important element in nowadays. The most developed countries are using ICT as means to accelerate development. Transport, for example, you can use ICT to tell you what kind of road infrastructure you have to put in place, how many road networks do you need by which year, using ICT. Don't you think that it could be integrated in some of the subjects or courses or programs that we provide as universities? For example, you are not complete if you do engineering without project management. It goes together. Don't you think that you need to couple it with ICT, especially engineering? Because it plays a major role in terms of development, traffic control as well, minimizing accidents on the road, ICT can play a major role. Don't you think that we need to couple those things so that we come up with a good package and also to be in line with the latest trends in terms of development? One problem that we're not getting out, I'm just raising it because you raised the issue of funding. I had thought initially it's not your area. We're not winning with admissions in our universities. Year in, year out, we have long queues. Where is the problem? Why can't it be resolved? Don't you think that is one thing that you must take with together with, come up with a study or something to see how best can we deal with this issue of long queues, as if we did not know, we did not think as a country that there will be admissions in the next year, financial year, using the assumptions of or the experience learned from the previous year, or the students at the at basic education who are ready to go to higher education. It's one area where we're not winning. We find ourselves wanting each and every year as a country. Don't you think that we should take that as a project so that we deal with it once and for all? One fails to understand why we're not. We have a council, we have a department, we have universities, but still we're not winning on this matter. What is the problem? Can't we deal with that one? The issue of accreditation to private institutions. I'm not an academic, but the manner in which they are many. We are very close to have them more than the students. There are so many of them. What criteria are we using to give them, to give accreditation? Some of them, even the qualities, the environment, the institution itself, you can see that it was not supposed to get an accreditation. What criteria do we use? What are the things that we look at before we give an accreditation to an institution? And I don't want to be politically correct. I don't want to be xenophobic. There are so many of them that are run by people from outside, which we appreciate. But my question on that matter, do we have targeted programs that will give accreditation over others? Take for example, in other programs we're overproducing. That is why we have graduates who are not employed. In other programs we're underproducing. But still you will have these private where we are overproducing given accreditation. My question is, as a country, do we know what we want? Where do we have limitations? Because for me, it will make sense if we give accreditation where we've got limitations as a country. What criteria do we use? Do we know what we want? And those are the issues for my side, Chair. Thank you. The first one is, please to clarify, so some of us are lay people regarding these acronyms that we use. What would be the difference then between the SACA or SACA as you pronounce it and HEQSF? What are the critical differences? And of the two, who is responsible for determining the NQF levels of any qualification that is offered by institutions of higher learning? What is CAT? What is the responsibility of CAT? My other question is with regard to the issues relating to transformation in institutions of higher learning. Transformation. We are sitting with a problem where there are institutions of higher learning that there is this transformation.
what is your role as a council for higher education in that regard? The issue of integration of the bursary schemes, that are there is a variety of bursaries in all institutions of higher learning, but I don't know the extent to which those bursaries are integrated also with NSFAS, so that we don't have a situation of students that are double dipping. They're getting a bursary, they're benefiting from bursary A, bursary C, NSFAS and things like that. How do we ensure the integration? And also, there is an outcry about the administration of NSFAS in institutions of higher learning. There are allegations of corruption. How are you dealing with that as a council for higher education? The staff establishment, I think one of the members did ask, your organogram for your establishment. But coupled with that, one would like to know whether you don't have problems of staff retention because your salaries cannot compete with other sectors like the public sector or any other sector, or you've been able to deal with that problem. You also made mention of the fact that you are looking into Bachelor of Social Work and LLB in terms of the review of the qualification. Why particularly those two? I just want you to understand why did you pick on particularly those. And also finally, as we cannot answer all the questions, but we'll just take a few at a time. We hope that you will be coming before the select committee once again sometime in the future. The issue of qualifications that are offered by our institutions of higher learning. Number one, you speak of public institutions of higher learning and private. The standardization of the certificate is if you speak in terms of basic education, for instance, let me cite this example. When a student attends a private school, they write IEB. In the public school, they write National Senior Certificate Examination. I want to know, in the case of universities, what happens, what is the currency of the certificate that you produce, whether it is when a person studies from a private institution. Is it of inferior or superior quality if it's a private institution or what? And who does the weighting? I think one of the members also did ask that question. Who does the weighting of the certificate? And what is our status with respect to the certificates that we produce in comparison with other African states? Where are we? Is South Africa having a high standard of education, or is South Africa, where do we rank ourselves as a country? Maybe those would be the few questions that one would have for now. Yeah, but congratulations for the clean audit. We are very proud of you. When we give money to entities, we want the money to be well looked after. And we do appreciate the clean audit. Thank you. Let me hand over to you then too.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I'll take some of the questions. I think the first one about the structure, we may not have the diagram there, but the structure of the Council on Higher Education is first we have a council, which I chair, which has 30 members appointed by the minister. And council has got subcommittees, the subcommittee on human resources and remuneration, and it has a committee on audit and risk, and it has an executive committee which does a lot of work in between council meetings, and it has a permanent committee in terms of the act called the Higher Education Quality Committee, the HQC, which is where you find a lot of these accreditation and audits and all the other work that is being done there. And then it also has a committee on monitoring and evaluation, where we look at trends and all these publications that we do and so forth. And the management structure is headed by the CEO. In this case, the acting CEO is Dr. Denise Webstock. And then we have a corporate services division, which handles all human resources and other related matters. And then we have a chief financial officer, who has just presented here. The division there, and then the monitoring and evaluation division. And we have a program accreditation division, which does all of these visits and all of those criteria that you asked about that we'll answer you later on. And we also have the institutional audits, where we do this quality enhancement project and other institutional audits, visiting, looking at quality assurance mechanisms, of course. And we also have a standards, national standards and reviews division, which is the one that did the social work and LLV and all that that we'll be following. And lastly, the promotion and coordination unit, workshops and conferences and so on and so forth across the sector. So that is the structure in a nutshell. Now, I'll attempt to answer some of the questions that were raised by Honorable Grunewald in terms of our role at the CHE. The first part of the question was about accommodation, what we are doing on accommodation at the CHE. Just to contextualize this issue about residences, we know that this is a very huge problem. We acknowledge that across the sector. And institutions of higher learning are not at the same level in terms of providing accommodation. But we also know that the Department of Higher Education and Training has been injecting quite a huge sum of money to develop this infrastructure in accommodation across the institutions. And this is ongoing, and as we speak, a lot of some of these institutions are being assisted to build more and more residences. But the demand is just too huge. And the physical location of some of the institutions is also a challenge. And I'm sure that honorable members have seen the publication that was issued by the department on the state of residences at universities. I happen to in my day job, I'm a vice principal at the University of Pretoria, and among other portfolios that I have is residences. And we know that affordability is also a very serious problem in terms of accommodation for our students. Many students that come into the system become poorer and poorer, and it becomes difficult to afford accommodation. Now, the role of the CHE in all of these, you will realize that by and large these are institutional matters. We have not undertaken any study to get to the root of the problem, apart from the fact that the department has done that. So it would be superfluous for us to repeat the same thing that has been done. We know that there is a demand, and there are all kinds of negotiations and partnerships that are taking place between institutions and some of the private providers to assist in certain instances. But again, affordability remains a problem. And the department itself has made initiative to see that more and more students get accommodation. If you look at Pretoria, for example, or the city of Tshwane, where you have Tshwane University of Technology and the University of Pretoria, which are by far the largest contact institutions where you require accommodation, it is a huge problem. And the CHE has not done that kind of work to actually determine what the problem is. Now, issues around NSFAS that you raised and the investment. in terms of the means test, and then the claim is put across the NSFAS. And NSFAS assesses it and pays if a student qualifies. So that investigation will take place as it has been announced by the minister, and we'll see what the outcome is out of this. Now, the question on consultants, I just want to put it in context because we also get that question a lot when we go to the National Assembly, and we try to explain it. The CHE is not a big organization. We have just about 51 staff members. And we rely very heavily on people in the sector, on experts in the sector, our peers, to actually do a lot of work for the CHE. In this case, they would be coming to conferences or reviewing papers or writing or working in workshops and so forth. Now, much of the cost that you see on consultants is about, you know, meeting attendance, you know, about people are not remunerated to do the work of the CHE as a traditional consultant that you know. It says that we will not be able to do what we do if we don't go to institution X and say, expect Y, assist us to complete this project. And people are doing it out of their own free will because this is not the subject paying job. But there are certain incidental expenses that we have to pay. And you find it in accreditation, you find it across the work that we do. And I'm sure the CEO can explain that much better. So that is the kind of work that we do with consultants. I will leave the curriculum question to the CEO, but let me get to the Northwest question that was posed and what the CHE is doing about the infighting that is possibly taking place at Northwest. As the Council on Higher Education, we have not really had Northwest on our agenda to actually discuss what is going on there. For the benefit of the committee, I happen to have been a registrar at Northwest University for quite a number of years before I went to the University of Pretoria. And I read in the papers. I read yesterday, I read on Sunday, I read all the time. I'm aware that there are issues going on there. But the committee should also remember that at all these universities, there are all sorts of things that are happening internally. And if the Council on Education was to get in every time people have a squabble, it will create problems for us because we just appeal that institutions should work well with one another. And this is the terrain, actually, of the Department of Higher Education. If there are management problems or governance problems and so on and so forth, that they should make quick interventions to arrest those problems before they deteriorate into what deteriorated the other institutions. And I guess Northwest is one case in point where you have differences and then you have this mudslinging in the newspapers and everywhere else. It is not good practice. It is not good management. I'm sure that intellectual people can handle things much better than they are. But at the Council on Higher Education, we had undertaken a project which we will publish shortly about governance and management problems. And these are very serious matters. You know, I was an administrator of TUC for some time when they had problems there. And you find that some of the people, either within management or within these governing bodies, tend to forget what the mandate of these institutions are. People bring in their personal agendas and biases and create serious havoc that collapses the system completely. And that is what we're trying to publish, to say these are the issues that we have come across as we interviewed all the people, you know, stakeholders within these institutions and so on and so forth. And that may probably assist places like Northwest, where they have their own problems at the moment. Now, the issue about SACO, the South African Qualifications Authority, we asked what the relationship is. I mean, they have an Act of Parliament that governs them to be an authority on qualifications, and we also have an Act that mandates us to do the qualifications framework, as well as at least a sub-framework for us. We work in collaboration. We have established a forum between these quality councils or the CEOs, where people share good practice and so on and so forth, so that at least we don't duplicate work, because it's a waste of resources. But there are no gaps and overlaps. Each one of us has got a very clear mandate on what we're supposed to be doing and not be doing. So we actually collaborate with one another to an extent that when we sit at a meeting of the Council on Higher Education, we have the chief executive officers of the quality councils and SACO included, so that they know what we're doing, and we also do the same with their meetings and so on and so forth. So there is that collaboration and working together so that we don't duplicate the services. I will attempt to answer other questions later, but I want to give other members of our panel to respond to some of them, where we have not responded, or we'll come back again, because we've noted all of them. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Acting CEO.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I think I just want to preface responses to some of the particular questions by some of the explanations that you're looking for. I think it's the CHE is quite a difficult animal to understand. On the one hand, it's not the department. Okay. So the department has a mandate. If there's a problem brewing at that institution, then it's going to sort it. That's not really our job. We are an organization that is required to think deeply about those problems, however. So our horizon is a medium to long-term view. So we're not going to go and sort out an immediate problem, because then we get involved in all sorts of political issues, like, you know, you were talking about the squabbles on a campus or whatever. That's not what we do. What we do is we have to look at, so what is happening in terms of student funding? Not an evaluation of NSFAS, because the department has done that. That's not what we would do. We would think about the problem of student funding as a phenomenon, and think in the long term, can we do research? Can we look at those comparator countries? Is there another way that we can do this? And so that's why it takes us quite a while, because we undertake the research, and on the basis of that, we would then give advice to the department. It actually has to carry out some of those things. So the minister would either accept or not accept that advice. So that's what makes it kind of difficult to understand, is because we take the long view. In terms of the South African Qualifications Authority, what I call SACWA, as you call SACA, that is a body, okay, as our chair said, set up by an Act of Parliament to look after education as a whole in the country in terms of its qualifications. Okay, so that's its role. So it likes to think of itself as the head of a family. And the other parts of the family are ourselves, which look after one part of that whole education system, Umalusi, which looks after the schooling part of the system, and the Quality Council for Trades and Occupations, which looks after vocational education and presumably all the colleges and what used to be in the CETAs and so on, CETAs, the Sectoral Education and Training Authorities. So when I talk about the HEQSF, it's a higher education qualification sub-framework. It's literally that. It's a framework. It's a ladder. So it's part of the NQF ladder, and the National Qualification Framework is the big ladder. So we have to worry about the qualifications on a part of that ladder. And then in thinking about that part of the ladder, we then take that from SACWA and we customize it for higher education and say, okay, these are the big levels. These are the descriptors of those levels at a high level. But what does that mean for a degree that is offered in higher education? And that's what we specify in the higher education qualification sub-framework. And then we take it further, and that was the question that was asked about how do we accredit, what process do we use, and so on. So, for example, let's say we are looking at a three-year degree in social sciences of some sort. We would first of all be looking at the overall levels in the big ladder. But our job would be, does it fit with what we have said the parameters of a degree are in the HEQSF? And we've described it. We said this is the purpose of a degree. This is what it looks like. This is how many credits it must have. And so on. This is how it must be put together before you can call it a degree. So that's one level. Then taking it down another level, we get a particular degree from University X. University X or private provider Y wants to offer a degree in social sciences. We then look at, does it fit those big parameters? Probably yes. But then we have another set of criteria. There are 19 criteria which break down into another 158 things that we look at. And so in that process, it's quite rigorous because, and this is where the consultants come in, so I'm answering a number of questions at once, okay. So we will get in this application for a degree in social sciences from University Y. We've asked them online, how do they think that they measure up in terms of those 19 criteria? So they will give us that information. We will ask things about, who's teaching this? What are their qualifications? What resources do you have to offer this? How is your program structured? Let's see the curriculum. Let's see what all your module outcomes are. We want to see the whole bank sheet. We will ask them about what are your systems for making sure your exams are safe? All of those things. So within those 19 criteria, there's a lot. We will then, as a first step, send that to what we call a peer evaluator. Now, a peer evaluator is an academic in the system who has some disciplinary knowledge about that. So it would be a social scientist that we would send that to. And that we would need to pay. We pay, and I think the rate is something like $2,750 to evaluate a program. It's a standard rate. We pay a lot of these people, which is why the consultant thing looks high, but it's lots of little bits. So that person will then evaluate that program. We will get the evaluator's report back. We'll say, is this a decent report? Have they covered everything? Have they looked at all of the information? Then goes to another committee of peers. We have another 20 people on an accreditation committee. They meet 5 times a year for 2 days at a time, and they prepare for a day for each of us. So it's a lot of work, and they take it seriously. They're not paid, but they do get an honorarium at the end. So we rely on a lot of goodwill in the system to actually make it work. They will then look at the evaluator's report and say, do we agree with that or not? We recommend that this program can be accredited, but they must do A, B, C, and D because we weren't happy with those. And then that goes to the Higher Education Quality Committee, which is yet another committee of peers, and they will say, but that's not the same kind of decision you made with institution Y. So are you being consistent here? So they will ask that kind of a question. And then finally the outcome will be there. So when you ask the question about the privates and the publics and the different degrees and what's the status and so on, what we can attest to is if it has been through the process it has met minimum standards. And I stress minimum standards because he said these are the things that are laid down that you have to have in place in order to have a license to offer this thing. It does not necessarily mean, however, that institution Y isn't going to go and offer a better product than institution X. They've both got the same minimum standards, but this one is going to offer something more than that one, which is why you will still see differences across the system. But what we want to assure the public is that they have at least, if they are accredited to offer, they have met some minimum standards. Now, also part of that accreditation process, I think the question was asked about, I think it was from you, about how are some of those things accredited, because they might not have the right premises and so on. They actually go and look. That's the game where we pull in what we call peer academic consultants. We'll put a team together of four or five and say, go and have a look. And there we ask all sorts of other questions about what's your library look like? How do your students access information? You're telling me it's all online, but then I have a look and I see that you don't have any subscriptions to journals, so what does that mean? They've only got Google Scholar, is that it? Not good enough. So then we would either say not accredited, or we would say, here's a condition. You have 6 months, a year, whatever, to develop those materials so that your students have access to them. So that's a little bit of a long explanation of how we do the accreditation part, but it answers some of the questions about differences between privates and privates and so on, and what the currency is. Now, in terms of the questions about how do we rate in relation to other countries, that's a tricky one because institutions are quite different. A lot of them play, as you will know, in some of the ranking systems. But they do that voluntarily. That's not something that we do. What we do have is agreements with other countries, and there's one at the moment that's on the table with other SADC countries and so on, about recognizing those qualifications. But now that is a SACWA function. The verifying qualifications are something that SACWA does. But what we do for them, for SACWA, is we can tell them which qualifications are accredited. So they will put that on their database. So we've done the accreditation, we tell them these and these are legitimate qualifications, SACWA will register them. So when you come and ask about, has this person got that qualification, SACWA will be doing the verification, but they will know that that's an accredited qualification because they've been to us. So we all work together on trying to do that, but that's not exactly our function. Similarly with verifying foreign qualifications, that's something that SACWA would do, but we as the chair explained, we have joint committees that we sit together so that we know what's going on in these different areas. And just recently they have produced a new policy, let's say, on evaluating foreign qualifications, and we would comment on that and say, yes, that's the right way to go, or you haven't thought about this, and so on. So that's how that bigger system works. Now let me look at some of the particular questions. I touched on the consultants and our chair has touched on that too. Just one further thing to say about that. I suspect, and my CFO can correct me, I think a big part of that 2.1 million you saw is actually a SACWA grant, which is the 1.5 million that we pay to them to manage a database of learner records for us. So already that cuts it more than half. And then as I explained, it's really the peer academics working for us for little bits and pieces and honoraria and lunch. Very often lunch. Okay. And then I talked about the different curricula, and the chair has dealt with Northwest. The fraudulent qualifications, we've also talked a little bit about that. I hope that satisfies you on that. Then there are some other questions I'm going to leave for the CFO about the structure, CFO on the structure of the organization. Foreign qualifications you've done. So the fraudulent qualifications, that's again a factor of competence. But we are all, and now when I say all, I'm talking about the FACWA family now, FACWA, CHE, Omalusi, etc., all working on a task team on that, to work out how FACWA can, or if it can, publish the names of those who have, and we can't say fraudulent, only a court can decide that, but have given misinformation about qualifications. So that's certainly a live issue that we're all looking at together about how that can possibly be done. And it's something that the minister desperately wants to happen. So again, there's collaboration on that. The issue about parents knowing where to send your child, and some of them are struggling. Again, I think we need to take our horizon into account. Our chair has talked about we don't look at that particular institution that is struggling. We look at what is the problem in the long term and can we do some research to resolve it. However, in addition to that, we do, I told you about the institutional audit process where we went into institutions. For instance, Northwest, which was a little while back now, and interviewed maybe 400 people in the process to find out what's going on, how does your management model work, how are you managing these three different campuses, and so on. And then as a follow-on from that, there might be issues that were outstanding that we will ask them to write us continual improvement plans on and progress reports about how they're dealing with that. A lot of those issues are transformation issues as well. So in that sense, we deal with that. So we are trying to monitor that on an ongoing basis. We also have, as part of those audits that are not closed yet because they're still busy with improvements, we will send, let's say, for example, our director of institutional audits to go and try to help an institution that is has just found that it is not able to put together a proper improvement plan. We have to go in there and say, so how can we help make this? And then we will work with the department. Do we need to put in a team? How do we do this? So there's a lot of that going on behind the scenes. We don't make all of that public just because we want the problem to get solved. Staff compensation we've talked about. Okay. Adverse impact. And I haven't got to my second page, but for the moment I will leave it and ask everyone to talk to some of the issues and come back to any that might be outstanding.
Before we come to the financial questions, I'd like Dr. Taylor to respond to some on transformation and other related matters. I will get back at some stage of the NSFAS questions that you asked.
Thank you very much, honourable member. I wonder if I could just make some broad comments, because I think that the questions that are coming from the provinces are really important. And I think it's important that we tell you what we're thinking. So the first point I want to make is that at its most basic level, the SONA debate and the National Development Plan seeks to enhance and raise the quality of life of the majority of our citizens. And education is seen as one way to raise the quality and the standard of a life that has been ravaged in the past. Okay? So what has actually been done around that, and how does the CHE, what does the CHE actually do? Now, firstly, the minister's role, he's abreast of the kinds of issues that are happening. So for example, at Northwest with the residences, there is a committee on looking at residences. In relation to funding, the Deputy President has led a funding committee on that as well. So there's a lot of thinking that is happening, and that as a CHE, we in a kind of, in a complex space between the department, the minister, and institutions. So we try to take an overall view of this landscape. How do we change our landscape that has essentially been an elite landscape of our education? So one had an enrollment of about 14% in our higher education system. We had about 300,000 students in the system, and predominantly white as well. 10 years later, that 14%, that 300,000, has actually risen to just under a million. So in terms of access and participation, we are making certain strides. I think the challenge for us is really what happens at the end in terms of the equity of outcome and the throughput rate, where we have huge challenges. And there is some of the kind of research that we're trying to do is to get through those challenges. And the recent, what the minister's done, and you're all aware of it, is to look at post-secondary schooling as a way, as an administrative unit, to try to redress the legacy in the different sectors of education, with adult education, labor, training, as well as vocational education. And the challenge for us as a CHE is to try to look at the integration and articulation, as both our chairperson and the CEO has mentioned, to look at the articulation of higher education with the post-secondary sector. And one of the crucial things around the Solana debate and the National Development Plan is really how do we use education as a way to redress the poverty and inequality in our society? And what kind of indicators do we use, A, and B, how do we select which programs do we accredit that is in the interest of raising the quality of life of the nation? I think those are huge challenges that we as a CHE, and I think our chairperson would acknowledge that as well. Another key challenge for our students is really around the transparency of the sector. I mean, our students want to know, you know, what's happening. So, you know, when they're participating in the sector in terms of governance structures, etc., a key kind of constitutional right of students is to be participating. And as a CHE, we want to be encouraging that. So a few last points I want to make is really around the constitutional, the question was raised, what are we doing about the fact that we have difficulties. And I think we can't underestimate the difficulties in higher education. What are we doing? Now, I think it's important for us to note that we're limited, because institutions have a constitutional right, which is to exercise autonomy. And you can only intervene up until a point. So the issue of curriculum is really an institutional matter. We will have problems with it, but the extent to which we can intervene, or the department can intervene, is fairly limited, and I think, and we've seen that. So why, you know, what are we doing about institutions who are resisting transformation? Well, there's not much that we can actually do, other than to have certain steerage mechanisms, which the minister is busy establishing, etc., to help steer the sector into a direction that is a lot more democratic. And I also have to state that the ranking system, I think you're right to raise that some institutions are better placed on the market than other institutions. And our role as a CHE is really to try to understand how we can start to support and raise the standard in institutions that have really been engineered to have a lower standard. And the recapitalization funds would be one way for us to do that. So let me end on that point. I think in a way I've tried to address quite a few of the questions. Around admission and universities, where's the problem? Well, the problem is in institutions, I'm afraid to say, because we have a central system which is around our matriculation system, which we invest huge amounts of fiscus in it. But institutions have what they call a national benchmark system, and they then decide on the basis of that national benchmark which students to admit. And then you funnel further down into institutions, so you've got the matric, then you've got the national benchmark, and then inside institutions, at the faculty level, you've got a point system. So the behavior of institutions is designed in such a way to make them and enable that they remain quite strong. And so what I'm really signaling is that, you know, the challenge is big. And that we try to really affirm, for example, in KZN, you know, the kind of stuff happening at MUT, very innovative, interesting areas around location-based university. I think it would be important for us to bring that into the system and to look at best practices as happening locally. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I think we'll move on to the other set of questions. Just to add that the Minister has actually established a transformation oversight committee, and he said in his budget vote he will be resourcing it in this financial year. And this is a committee that will be looking deeper into issues of transformation across the sector within these institutions. So I will leave the other bit to the CFO to respond to. We'll come back later.
Thank you, Chair, and members of this committee. Just for to respond to the four issues that were raised in relation to finance, the issue of the monogram and the structure of the organization, I think the Chair highlighted the strategic structure of the organization. Just to respond in detail in terms of why the composition of employees are higher than the goods and services. I'm trying to highlight to the members to note that it's basically around the number of employees that are within each program. And then the highest number of employees within the program is on goods and services, is on corporate services. And when you look at the, I'm trying to highlight this so that you can understand, when you look at the salaries, our salaries, most of our salaries are at the management level, at manager level. And obviously, with the little number that we have with management, with employees at that level, there are any more. And when there are any more, obviously, that means your total salary will be at the higher level. And we are trying to retain, as the other question that was talking about, the retention. There is a policy in place from corporate services in terms of trying to retain the current employees that we have so that we don't have the high turnover of employees. Currently, the council approves under the leadership of the chairperson, especially at senior manager level, where they decide whether this kind of employee at this particular position can be retained, and then there's what we call, they have introduced it last year, retention allowance, which is reviewed annually in terms of the kind of the work that particular individual is doing. So there is a kind of other retention strategies that are in place to make sure that we retain the current employees within our organization. And as I said, when you look at the structures that I just reflected in the second highest program with a higher number of employees is accreditation with 11 employees, followed by institutional audit and monitoring and evaluation at seven employees, and then national review at 4, and obviously COE at 6. Now, the highest people in terms of, you know, you get the DPSA structure, is the CEO followed by the CFO, and then other directors paid at the director's level. And other employees are within management, which we call level 9. And what CET is trying to do, majority of the employees are paid at the highest scale. That is part of trying to retain the employees that we have within. And the total number of employees that we have budgeted for 2015-16 is about 53. And this is the structure that was in place before. And it's I'm trying to address the issue that was raised by my committee member, where he says that normally the structure follows the function. Yes, the cut that was done is not the current cut that we are talking about. This was 3 years back when the structure was also in place. The experience of cutting the budget, the baseline, is not now. It happened even 3 years back. And by then we had this type of a structure in place, with the kind of the salary scale that we were paying before.
hence the issue of the salaries being high. Addition to that, which is part of what I didn't say to the members, is the issue of we normally provide for bonuses. And I think as a healthy institution, where the payment is due for eligible people that have worked hard, you need to pay them. I'm not saying that all officials are eligible to be paid bonuses, but there is structures in place in terms of looking at the performance and all that. So we normally provide so that when the result of the committee comes back to us in terms of payment, we don't struggle to say we don't have funds. We know that we have provided for the provision for the bonuses. So I wanted just to highlight and show the picture. Coming back to the issue that was raised in terms of the why the increase in terms of the income, in terms of the presentation that I was done, I think it's very clear, the other member was saying why there's a decrease in terms of other income. The amount that is reflected as new mandate standard development is decreasing because there was an allocation for that particular program to be developed. We are not going to get any funding, federal funding for that. So obviously there's a decrease because we are spending as per the mandate. And there is a decrease that you are asking why there's a decrease. When you look at other income, the amount there is fixed because, as I said, we are not sure. This is a projected other income. It can be higher or lower. But the main reason why there is on other income there is a decrease is basically around the new mandate standard development, where the income, where the source of income was allocated is now decreasing because we're at the implementing phase now. We are at the final phase of implementing what was required by the Department of Higher Education. I think I covered the issue of the retention, the issue of the budget in terms of the COE, and also the issue of consulting, just to close. The same chairperson of council, together with other members, mandated us this year, I don't know if it's this or last year, to address the issue of confusion between consultants that we normally experience when we come to Parliament. We agreed, and Chair, maybe you are not aware, we have developed a totally different line items to explain easier to anybody. We try to define a consultant, peer academics, this is a new word that we have implemented based on what they just explained, and then we have outsourced service, which is totally different from a consultant. We also have contractors. So our reporting will be having those four items to separate so that it's easier to anybody looking at our financials. Because EPA academics is basically what the chairperson and the CEO explained. It is that our peer academics that are assisting us to achieve our mandate is not pure consultant. As a consultant, that means you are appointed or registered as a consultant. So these people are not really consultants, they are just peer academics. So we have developed that guideline, we have developed that payment rate in terms of how we're going to pay them so that it's easier and they can be audited by the Auditor General, and then we are happy with that process. So coming to you next time, you'll see a different name called peer academics, just to address this fear and this confusion to all members of Parliament around the issue of consultants, so that it's clearer and everybody can understand what is our role. So I think we have done much on this issue and we are winning on that. So I think those are the issues that I wanted to cover in terms of the finance. Thank you.
Do you want to add something, CEO, before the chairperson makes his concluding remarks?
Thank you, Chair. There were just one or two outstanding issues. You asked how do we choose whether to do Bachelor of Social Work or LLB, whatever. Most of that comes about because there's an issue, and let's say in the LLB, we were first approached about this by the Law Society many years back, and we did some research for them, and then the law deans got involved, and it's because they want it. Okay, the sector wants it. So really, that's what determines why we do those and not some other. It's because we can see that they are receptive to that now, so let's work where they are wanting it and where we're receptive to that. There was a question about how do we organize which programs to accredit. This is another just a noted explanation. And that is, we are not responsible for saying whether we should have more engineering programs or more whatever. That's a departmental function. And what they do, certainly in the public sector, is they will look at a program and an application from an institution, and they will make a determination, and my colleague here behind me does that work, looking at whether they would be prepared to fund that, because do we need such a program at that time? So there's a, in a way, it's a kind of a steering mechanism. They then pass it to us and say, is this a good program or is this not a good program? So we answer that question. We don't answer whether they should be offering a degree in engineering or not. We will say, do they have the capacity to do that? Is it a good program? So there are systems that try to control that. You can't steer it absolutely, because as my other colleague has pointed out here, there is institutional autonomy in terms of curriculum. But we do try to make sure that resources are spent wisely and that we're looking at the quality of projects. And then your other question, my last comment here, about the curriculum and ICT and how it's integrated. Again, we can't tell an institution what their curriculum should be, but there are certain criteria that we use. And one of them would be, if you are in this particular field, and you are saying that you're using ICT, we would ask lots of questions about that. And there are some horror stories that come across. We see some institutions trying to teach ICT on books, no computers. How does that work? Obviously, that will raise questions for us. And we will write back and explain, how are you going to do that? It's not, in our minds, that's not really feasible. But again, the project that we're talking about, looking at ICT, is about the bigger policy questions that arise from doing that. What are the intellectual property laws that pertain to doing that? What about sharing resources and licensing across the system? Those kinds of things would be things that we would be worrying about.
Before the chairperson of council makes this conclusion remark, the members, I think they've got all the questions. Honourable Dlamini, then Honourable Dlamini. No, thank you very much. Honourable Chair, very interesting engagement. We really appreciate that. You can tell we're dealing with intellectuals today. Some of us miss that. You can even hear the manner in which they respond to questions. You read between the lines, okay, my question is answered here and there. They're not direct to questions. We really appreciate that. But I think, Honourable Chair, there is a need, because these issues that we're talking about, some of them are really serious matters that can change the country's landscape if addressed properly. Maybe there is a need for a forum or what, taking from the NDP, what does NDP say this sector can do to change the landscape? Just have a debate around that. What is our contribution as the sector? Maybe we do need a forum, whether it's organized by them or organized by the department, but I'm just flagging it out that there is a need to follow up on that. It also includes the issue of the ICT to accelerate development, as much as not your direct responsibility, but the question, my issue was that how do you advise the minister or the department to consider that all the institutions, I spoke about the well-developed countries, Singapore, every year they bring together all cities in the world, all of them, to talk about these issues. How do we, looking at the rate of urban development, urban migration versus the resources and the pace of development, they ask this question, how do we use ICT to accelerate development so that we're able to meet the demands of urban development? These are the things that we must discuss and look at them and how to advise. One last thing that I was not clear, I want to make a specific example about this external qualification. I'm not saying those people who are lying about their qualification, they're right, but maybe let's look at the environment. You know, I did not lie, I'm not defending anything.
let's look at the environment. I want to use an example. Like, I have master's certificate on project management. I got it from George Washington University. This is not a South African university. Honestly, I attended 4 years, got that qualification. But only to find that later, when it is followed and questioned, I can't go to England. I don't know where George, wherever it is coming from. My question on that matter is, when there is a university that is not a South African university, is there a link between yourself or the department and that institution, so that when I get that qualification, we all know that it is a legitimate qualification? Because if I say I have this, they phone them, they say they don't know. Maybe I did not verify even myself before I started the program. That was the question, to say, what is the link between us and those universities?
Thanks. CFO, you said you keep your salaries at maximum of all the scales. What I want to know is, does that fit into your critical skills, or is just all your workforce? Because, you know, when I look at some of them, I'm alarmed a little bit. Your PA to the CEO, for example, is that a critical and a scarce skill? Just an example. Thanks.
Will the acting CEO or the chairperson respond?
Thank you, Chair. I can answer that and some of the remarks that were made. About the staffing remuneration, perhaps we need to paint the context here that the CHE competes, among others, with universities for people with high-level skills, with intellectual depth, and obviously universities pay more than the CHE well in public sector skills and so on and so forth. So we have had a history of losing very good people at the CHE because they go to work at other places and so forth, which is why we asked the minister as well as the Minister of Finance to help us get a retention allowance of some kind to keep those critical skills that the Honourable Member is asking about. And these are people that that engage at high level, that produce high quality documents that are reliable for the image of the organization. So it is not people who have low level kind of skills that you can get anywhere. So that competition is very, very stiff, and to retain people is quite serious for us, because we need continuity. We need for us to actually make an impact in the sector. And if you look at the overall staff establishment, this is a very small organization. If you were, for example, to compare to NSFAS, when you're asking questions about NSFAS, it has over 220 people, and it's quite big and a lot of money. Now, the question from the last honorable member on foreign qualifications, she's gone now. Okay, I'll answer when she gets back. I'll get back to that one. Let me get back to the issue that was raised earlier as a way of concluding, Chair, on student housing that Honourable Hunavald asked. The department has called in all the key stakeholders on the 22nd of June at the University of Johannesburg to go and discuss this issue with also private providers, you know, publics, technical and TVET colleges and so on and so forth. So we'll be handling some of these things. We'll see what the outcome of that will be. On NSFAS, some remarks were made about NSFAS. And I'd like to, Chairperson, I don't want to speak on behalf of NSFAS because I'm on a different mandate now, but we can provide a bit of clarity because I serve on that board of NSFAS. And I usually say to people, lately it has become topical and everybody else has become an expert on NSFAS. So the fact of the matter is that NSFAS handles a lot of money, just under
the maybe just to assist you on that one, we are going to be meeting NSFAS in any case. Next week, maybe we are going to have a lot of deliberation at that point, so don't worry about a lot of explanation.
That helps a lot because I was hoping to give you clarity on some of the things, but it doesn't matter. So the other question that she mentioned on foreign qualifications, fraud with these qualifications is a very serious problem in this country and elsewhere. But there are mechanisms that we have in the country that are assisting to detect the fraud with these foreign qualifications. We have organizations like the MIE, SACO itself, as we have said, is tasked with the verification of these qualifications. So if you get a qualification elsewhere, then it has to go through the SACO internal processes for them to actually verify if there is such an institution, if it exists, and if it is, you know, offering that specific qualification and so forth. We have had many cases in this country where, I mean, in my former life as a registrar, you go in and out of court to go and actually testify that a person would say they have a qualification from, let's say, UNISA or Northwest, and the name of the qualification is BURIS, and you find that this university has never really offered a qualification like that. So you have a lot of these. But there are mechanisms. The problem is big, but the mechanisms to actually detect it. When we had the Prime Minister of Technology appointment of a Vice Chancellor with a fraudulent qualification, I dealt with that matter firsthand. And the question was, do you have this qualification or not? And if you do, produce evidence that you have it. Because according to our verification processes at SACO, there is no such an institution with such a qualification. But it happens and people slip through in other places. But again, as we said, this is the competence of SACO to actually see that it happens. In fact, the institutions themselves, when I was with the Health Professions Council for many years, worked in the health sector, you find a lot of foreign doctors coming into the country. But even then, there are certain steps that are taken to actually verify with global organizations, internal ones, including supervision and exams in order for people to come and practice here. So you can't just come in and say, I have this. But certain people speak through, you see it in the papers all the time. And it is an endemic problem, which of course is being addressed. As you know, the minister has asked SACO to actually develop a database for naming and shaming people. If you do this, you get laid there like a blacklist kind of thing, which SACO has, I'm told, has completed now. It will probably be out very soon. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. No, thank you very much. I think we've come to the end of our engagement with CHE. Thank you for the presentation, and also thank you for the responses that you have given to our questions. It was indeed a very fruitful engagement, given the fact that who are meeting the council for the first time in the NCOP. There are a lot of other issues that we'd have loved to raise, but we can't, because as I did explain earlier on, we've got various other engagements after this that we need to run into. But before I close, I don't know if the Department of Higher Education wants to say something. I don't want to close you out of the process.
Chairperson, I think we just echo the comments by the committee in the sense that I think it was a very good session with the CHD, and I think a follow-up session could do a lot of good in the system as a whole. We appreciate the work that the committee is also doing. Thank you very much.
There was a suggestion by the committee members that maybe we need to have a follow-up session, whether it is in the form of a workshop or whatever nature, but just to have an opportunity as members of the select committee to have further clarity on the issues, because one does realize that your mandate is very broad. It's very, very broad, and I'm actually surprised, to be honest with you, to realize that your content is so small. I thought I would see big numbers given the enormity of the task at your disposal, but I think it will grow as you take the processes forward. And also, I want to appreciate on behalf of the committee the clean audit. It is highly appreciated, but we do regret that we've got concerns about the cuts that have been effected on the baseline. We all are dependent on what we are given by Treasury, but whenever it is possible for us to plead your case, we can always do so, because when people can actually demonstrate and there is evidence that they are doing good work, nothing will actually prevent the committee from saying that this body deserves much more. Please come to their rescue and help them to realize the objective on behalf of the Department of Education and the nation. When we had an engagement with the department, the issues relating to transformation that I spoke about, the minister actually said on the day, this committee, because our responsibility is oversight over all these institutions, we can't reach through to all of them. It's not possible. Not even during the 5-year term that we have. But at least we could visit those where we do realize that there are problems of resistance to transform. And then he said, invite them. As self committee, invite those institutions of higher learning, be it universities or colleges, to come and explain why is it that they are resisting to transform. Because education is an apex priority of government, and we all want to ensure that we channel resources but also get quality. We get our return on investment. I don't want to belabor the point. Once again, I want to say thank you to the council. Keep up the good work they have started doing. I know they have got challenges, but we, as a collective, we can always overcome the challenges and the obstacles on the way. Thank you to the department as well. Your support is always appreciated. Thank you. The meeting is adjourned. There are refreshments outside. Thank you.